Good evening, everyone. Between the idea and the reality falls the shadow. So says T.S. Eliot, speaking to us from Poets' Corner. Last week, Canon White inaugurated this remarkable lecture series, and he did so by brilliantly analysing what Eliot might have meant by the term the shadow, the eternal and irreconcilable incompatibility between idealism and pragmatism. It's my privilege tonight to welcome you all here, particularly our friends from America, and to introduce Britain's leading theological intellect, Canon White. And I'd like, if I may, to start by thanking the Dean and Chapter and the Receiver General of Westminster Abbey for arranging this lecture series, and the brilliant director of the Westminster Abbey Institute, Claire Foster Gilbert, for arranging for us all to be here. Perhaps I could introduce him in this way. As you listen to Canon White, you will see how the shadow, as Eliot called it, like any good Hollywood villain, holds very powerful cards. Some would say the ace of trumps, as in what I'm sure you hear 10 times a day, I certainly do, which is, what is all this moral mumbo jumbo? It's all hot air, philosophical claptrap. What's it got to do with the time of day? New Jerusalem, the promised land. It's irrelevant. We don't have our head in the clouds. Our feet are firmly on the ground, and there's a job to be done. You must hear that a lot. But Canon White has his cards too, more powerful, as you're going to hear. He has the three great documents of Western civilization. There are, of course, only three, as we all know. They all have the same structure relating to what Canon White's going to say, said last week, and will say again tonight. There is no shadow of pragmatism anywhere in them. They are a denunciation of immorality, followed by a call to arms for a moral crusade. I'm speaking, of course, of the greatest political speech ever written, the Sermon on the Mount, in which, as we heard, after Jesus Christ had spoken, it came to pass that the people were astounded by his doctrine. No shadow there. The American Declaration of Independence, probably the most vicious condemnation of a English king that has ever been written. It ends, as you know, "We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." And the third, as you know, the Communist Manifesto. "Philosophers have only interpreted the world," it says. "The point, however, is to change it." Isaiah Berlin described the Communist Manifesto, or the Marxist socialist movement that followed it, as the greatest organized social movement of all time. "Greater, perhaps," Berlin said, "than the rise of Christianity against paganism." So, we are going to learn tonight from Canon White, how did they defeat the shadow? What happened when they said, as Tennyson did, also down in Poets' Corner, "I am half sick of shadows"? To explain how it's done, may I present the Canon Theologian of Westminster Abbey, Canon White.
Uh, My thanks to Lord Saatchi for that very generous introduction, after which I can't help fearing things can only go downhill. I will try to dispel some shadows. We'll see how we go. But before I set off downhill, so to speak, perhaps a brief summary of last week might help. For those who weren't here last week, and indeed, perhaps for those who were as well. What I tried to do was to identify the experience, which I want to interrogate in all three lectures, in fact, in different ways, an experience whose underlying implications I want to explore, an experience public servants may identify with most sharply, but I think it's pretty universal too. And last week, I tracked it in a number of contexts. I found it in a right-wing writer of the First World War trenches, in a liberal left-leaning public intellectual in the UK's corridors of power in the late 20th century, and in a contemporary radical Christian ethicist from the American South. And actually, I found it, and I find the experience in myself too. It's the experience of having ideals which we feel we cannot fulfill. It's the experience of thwarted visionaries. It's when the eye sees further than the hand can reach. It's the experience of having to compromise when ideals hit the rock of reality. And the examples I suggested showed a range of reactions to that experience. The first, the soldier poet, kept his ideals but actually denied reality completely and retreated into fantasy. The second, the political philosopher, adapted his ideals, but only with regret, and eventually withdrew from public life. The last, the Christian ethicist, accepted that we'll always face contradictions with our ideals when we try to put them into practice, but he tried to hold them together in his character, his deepest dispositions, even when they were thwarted in practical living. I then described, with the help of a German philosopher, Karl Jaspers, why we experience like this as inevitably compromising. It's not just because of our own moral deficiencies. It's the way we and the world are structured. It's because we're only finite agents with inevitably limited reach in any world structured by space, time, and change. It's also because we're idea makers as well, who form general principles to try and understand the world, but then find these principles obviously cannot cover every particular situation, so we have to compromise between our principles and the claims of the particular. And I then looked for even deeper reasons why the world is like it is. I sketched a wider metaphysic, if you like, of the world, in which these limits of finitude, space, and time are not just a product of random chance. They're an intended, created order to make the world a theater of the spirit. That is, these limits are necessary to generate profound purposes, meanings, virtues, such as sacrificial love, courage, deep cooperation, compassion, faith, humility, which can only be generated in a world where we have to struggle to realize our ideals in the face of these limits. What I also suggested was the transcendent dimension which all this then points to. Because as our ideals strain against their limits, their very persistence and the persistent dissatisfaction, even guilt we feel when they're thwarted, implies that there is actually a resolution somewhere to be found for all this, even if not in this life and this world. In Karl Jaspers' philosophy, that somewhere was only a shadowy, undefined abstraction. In Christian faith, it has much more definition. God is the ultimate mover and resolution of it all. And the narrative of Christ shows this God at work, pressing his ideals through the compromises and limits of human life, the human life of Christ, forging these deep virtues of the Spirit in the process, and then finally confirming there is indeed a resolution beyond in those mysterious narratives of resurrection and ascension. And then finally, last week, I suggested that reframing reality in this metaphysical or religious way isn't just offering a theoretical resolution. It can also form practical dispositions in us. It means we will or may be people who should be realistic, because we've accepted that compromise is inevitable. We're not just retreating into fantasy or a sense of false guilt when we hit those rocks of reality. Yet, it may help us still be motivated, precisely because those ideals remain real in God, and as such, they can remain real in our own deep dispositions, even when they're thwarted in many or some of our actions and decisions. So that was the overall argument of last week. But there was a large assumption behind it all, and those of you who were there last week were kind enough not to point out in the questions that I hadn't really defended or identified it properly. The assumption I was operating with was simply that these pressing but unsatisfied ideals we experience really do have this sort of authority, the sort of authority which requires a metaphysical or religious explanation. It's the assumption that these ideals are not just trivial facts of human psychology or biology, the sort of things people have much as they have a taste for chocolate or an occasional headache. They actually have a unique character which needs further explanation. And that's what I want to pursue now, because it's by digging deeper into this unique authority of moral ideals that paradoxically, I think, we'll also find something to help us when we find we inevitably have to compromise them. And as last week, to pursue this, I'll draw on a little philosophy, a little theology, and perhaps some literature as well. Now, by digging deeper, I should hasten to add, right at the beginning, I do not mean that we have to dig deeper in this sort of way to be morally serious people. Of course not. George Eliot, also in Poet's Corner, would offer a good example from her literature. Her background was certainly not religious or metaphysical in any overt way. It was actually a more empirical, pragmatic, Victorian agnosticism. She was deeply morally serious, but out of that background of agnosticism and a good deal of pragmatism, she felt no great need to explore any absoluteness of the moral demand. She appealed to what is possible. When our eyes see further than the hand can reach, all that experience requires is simply to be faithful to what is possible in the circumstances. There's no great residue that I can see of dissatisfaction in someone like George Eliot that we need to worry about, even when we can't go further. Really, all that matters is the old mantra of politics. Bismarck, wasn't it? It's just the art of the possible. So, nicely illustrated in the oft-quoted final reflections of her novel Middlemarch. Writing about her heroine, Dorothea, she says this: "The determining acts of her life were not ideally beautiful, just the mixed result of a young and noble impulse struggling against the conditions of an imperfect social state. Yet this still resulted in fine issues, for the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts." That things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who simply live faithfully a hidden life. In other words, unlike the writers of tragedy I was citing last week, real morality in this kind of temperament is not really just about the ideals of heroic or historic acts which aspire to meet some absolute metaphysical divine demand. It settles with a more limited view of life, just for what's possible, what will at least make things not so ill as they would have been. And it is very tempting to settle with this. Why can't we detoxify these ideals we feel pressing in on us and see them not as some absolute external authority which really needs explanation, which needs reaching for all the time, but just see these ideals as useful fictions of the mind to keep us going as far as we can? Preachers and philosophers may worry that's not enough, but then we Brits, if you'll just excuse me excluding you for the moment, have a very good track record in ignoring both preachers and philosophers. The trouble is, I'm both a preacher and a philosopher. You have the misfortune to be listening to me tonight for a while, and I cannot just leave it there with that kind of pragmatism. So let me explain why I think it is always worth digging deeper, not to be a morally serious person, of course we can without that, but in doing that, to find out that if we do reflect honestly and deeply on moral idealism, it has a unique nature which does lead us beyond pragmatism to metaphysics and faith. Three features of morality which lead me in that way inexorably. First, there is the extraordinary and ineradicable energy of the moral impulse, the way it keeps resurfacing across all time and space and culture. I don't mean its resurgence in fundamentalist cultures now, where there's strict uniformity about what is right and wrong, or believed to be. There's also huge moral energy, I suggest, in liberal societies, where there's a lot of disagreement about what is right and wrong. Even here, I suggest, we never lose the powerful sense that there is a right and wrong about things, and this matters, even though we can't always agree about what it is. The massive moral energy in France displayed recently in reaction to the massacre of journalists springs to mind as an example of it. And a particularly telling way to show this, to demonstrate it, to show how basic moral energy persists even in liberal societies with big areas of moral relativism, is the way this moral energy gets displaced into new areas rather than just disappearing. Rather than being dissipated by relativism, moral energy sort of reappears, it surfaces, in issues like the quest for efficiency, accountability. For example, when mistakes of simple inefficiency or negligence rather than malice are made at work or in public life, we quite often find people's reactions are just as searing as if it was malice. Why? Because these reactions to inefficiency, I suggest, actually have this displaced moral energy behind them. Quite wrongly, I would say, but that's where it's coming from. Put another way, if a culture of relativism means we're no longer sure about what is morally right or wrong, about sexual ethics, or about what constitutes a just war, we simply attach our moral energy instead to lambasting some hapless call operator for the inefficiencies of their company. It's this displacement which has spawned both the litigious and the bureaucratic elements of our society. But the point is, this actually shows how irrepressible that underlying moral energy is. It's got to go somewhere, so it ends up here with litigious and vexatious and bureaucratic minutiae. And because of that ineradicable energy, it surely begs the question, if it's like this, just what is it? Where's it coming from? The second feature of the moral impulse, which begs that sort of question, is its utterly distinctive nature. The fact that it just cannot be reduced to anything else other than itself. Now, of course, we can try to demystify it. Many have tried to. Explain it just as a product of social or natural conditioning, just a socio-biological kind of reality we have. It's very easy to tell that sort of story. Our evolutionary origins drive us to survive. For that, we must cooperate. Cooperation requires a measure of self-sacrifice. And so what we've taken to be a distinctive moral set of claims on us is actually derived only from disguised survival and expediency. The whole moral sense is really just a disguised outcrop of evolutionary needs and so on. It all sounds very plausible, but it really doesn't wash, does it? It's that word just an evolutionary product, which betrays the slippery nature of the argument, exposes its flaw, the flaw of what's called the genetic fallacy. That's the error of thinking. We can always know the full nature of the outcome of a process just from the nature of the process which produced it. In this case, the error of assuming that because evolutionary processes cause the outcome of a so-called moral impulse, the moral sense is itself nothing but a disguised survival or expediency instinct. It simply doesn't follow. It would be like saying that because the biological means of conceiving a child don't themselves require thought, feeling, or love, the outcome produced, the child, itself has no capacity for real thought, feeling, or love. Just disguised form of a biological process, which is nonsense. Of course, a child has a capacity for personal thought and feeling, even if the processes for producing a particular child were utterly impersonal. In the same way, of course, the meaning of the moral impulse we experience can be distinctively moral, even if the socio-biological processes producing it were not. This fact that our moral impulse actually is really distinctive is clearest, I suggest, in moral extremes. When we encounter something obviously, utterly evil, like the gratuitous hurting of vulnerable young people, or like the monstrosities of ISIS, we are repelled with a weight of feeling, a distinctive weight of feeling, which requires distinct categories and language. We cannot, we do not see these sorts of things as just inexpedient or impractical, but precisely as wrong, as evil. Similarly, when we encounter utterly and heroically good acts, whether these are the radically heroic Christ-like lives, like a Mandela's, or the self-sacrificing heroic love of many unknown lives, unknown carers up and down the country who've consistently subordinated their own needs to care for another. When we encounter these sorts of things, we're moved and attracted by them, rather like the way great beauty attracts us, in a unique, distinct way. We do not see them just as a disguised form of expediency or social contract, but as qualitatively different. They really are morally good, not just expedient. And so again, this distinctive quality surely begs the question, how can we account for it? Where does this extraordinary and distinctive meaning of the moral impulse come from? The third telling feature of the moral impulse is its perfectionism, its drive to keep transcending limits, which I mentioned last week, the, if you like, the infinity of its ideals. I found this most usefully explored by another political philosopher, Simon Critchley. an atheist, as it happens, but in fact that makes his analysis much more compelling. Because even as an atheist, naturally wary of religion or metaphysics, he still finds in the moral impulse this quality of infinity, its persistent need to push and transcend limits. He actually describes it in much the same way as Martin Luther describes the unique authority of the conscience. Its push and pull is so cutting, so infinite, it never seems satisfied. In his own words, it endlessly vivisects us, cuts ever deeper. And it wouldn't do this, says Critchley, if it was just a pull of pragmatism. It only does so as a distinct call of moral perfectionism. Perhaps I can make it more concrete. Just think of the dynamics of an encounter you or I might have with someone who falls in the street in front of us as we walk out of here back up Victoria Street tonight. What we may experience is not just a limited contractual or reciprocal claim on us. It's potentially limitless. Yes, superficially the claim might seem to be limited. Oh, help him to his feet if you can and have got the time. And implicitly contractual, because someone might do the same for me one day. But if we're honest, doesn't the claim sometimes seem a lot more? In your mind, somewhere, should I also check whether there's anyone else to look after him? Take him to the hospital even? And it can go further. Through this one person, we may begin to wonder about others. Should I begin to work for wider social justice to help all other such claimants? Maybe he's an ex-serviceman whom we did not collectively help enough when he returned damaged from the war we sent him to. So what should I do about that, too? In other words, the claim begins to feel infinite, something Critchley can only describe, in his words, as a godlike claim, like meeting universal ideals and responsibilities that could only belong ultimately to a God. Critchley doesn't believe in God, remember. Yet in this infinite nature of the moral idealism he and we experience sometimes, he feels he has to reach for this quasi-religious language to account for it, as did Plato, as did Kant before him. And so once again, why? Where is it coming from? How do we account for this limitlessness of it? Well, in a moment, I will suggest a worldview to account for it. For as you'll no doubt realize, that's where I'm heading. But perhaps just before that, this clarification, and this is really for any, perhaps many here, thinking they are actually more like George Eliot, and that actually we don't usually experience the moral impulse like this as some sort of infinite burden. If you're feeling like that, let me assure you, I'm not for one moment suggesting that this sort of moral intensity is how we all normally experience life. Perhaps it is for some, but I hope not. I suspect that for many of us, what we feel morally, day to day in routine acts and decisions, in public service or in private life, is rather less than that, actually little different than the sort of feeling we probably have about what we had for lunch. We may be generally nourished by a sort of underlying sense of right and wrong in our routine life, but we're hardly overwhelmed by the taste of it all the time. We're not routinely sensing moral choice in the way I've just described it, as this unique, intense, authoritative, infinite demand, compelling metaphysical reflection in a place like this. Put another way, we're not actually all the time Hamlets, Lears, Othellos, Antigones, constantly torn with tragic moral angst. We're probably more like Shakespeare's wise fools, getting on with reality more pragmatically, just moving things on to the next scene. And if so, I would say thank God, because humankind cannot bear too much reality, and no one can live all the time with too much intensity. But of course, the point is, that is not my point. That is to say, not what we're routinely experiencing morally. My main concern is precisely the underlying meaning of morality, something which I agree is not always apparent on the surface of life, but which does surface in some of those extreme situations of good and evil. And it's that underlying meaning of it and nature of it which does keep pressing the question, what then is it? Where does it ultimately come from? So now to that answer, if you like. Simple, perhaps obvious, but something which emerges to my mind utterly naturally. What we're encountering in this unfulfillable moral ideal with its unique authority is what even Critchley found himself half driven to in spite of himself. In this moral sense, we're simply meeting the mind and will of a personal God. Now, that intimate and natural connection between our moral sense and a religious sense is, in my view, the most enduring and convincing of all the classic bridges which have been built between general human experience and the reality of God. Though next week I will mention just one other too, which has similar power, I believe. But why do I say this? There's this natural connection? Just think for a moment of the push and pull of the moral impulse, what it's like. I think we would all agree it's actually very like meeting at least another human mind and will. To meet a powerful and attractive human personality is precisely to feel their mind, their will, their desires impinging on us in just the way a strong moral claim does, pushing us away from things that they don't like and want, pulling us towards things they do like and want. So if in our conscience we're experiencing the same sort of push and pull, in a uniquely energetic, ineradicable, authoritative, infinite form, which as such couldn't be just a human voice, then it is natural indeed to see it as the will of a personal God. We may be embarrassed to name it as such. We may even be embarrassed to own having such a strong moral sense at times, let alone a sense of God. Ernest Hemingway said once, I quote, his feeling of consecration to a duty towards all of the oppressed of the world was as difficult and embarrassing to speak about as a religious experience. But he had that sense. And actually, that's what it was, a moral sense which was also a religious experience. I should say quickly, identifying the two does not for one moment mean we always experience the content of the divine will reliably in our conscience. Of course not. The moral impulse is always mediated, distorted by our flawed humanity and flawed surrounding culture. That's why there's so much moral disagreement, especially in a liberal society. But the form of the moral experience and impulse, however flawed its content, does remain godlike for all the reasons suggested, and so much more compellingly explained as such than as a purely social or socio-biological instinct. Perhaps you've needed no persuading of this, but many do. And perhaps all of us need some persuasion to overcome the difficulty and embarrassment in actually naming our deepest moral convictions as also religious experiences, which is one reason for making it explicit in times and places like these lectures, just to give voice and language to these underlying realities which do in fact shape us all. And the other reason for making it explicit brings me to the final part of the lecture, which is more about the practical difference it makes if we are willing to give this moral impulse an explicit metaphysical or religious location and meaning. So that's what I now move to. What does all this now add up to in our practical experience, of actually living with these impossible moral ideals and with the compromises they inevitably bring. Well, paradoxically, first, I think it provides us, or should, with a huge and proper sense of release. Relief as well. I say paradoxical because naming a moral impulse as the divine will might seem to be more crushing, give it more weight. In fact, it's the opposite. Because this should provide release from a sense of ultimate responsibility. After all, if this sense of infinite universal responsibility, this impulse to perfection, really comes ultimately from God, not just from our own minds or society, then of course we cannot be finally responsible for completely fulfilling it. How can we be finally responsible for what we have not created, that which has come from beyond? It echoes a point I made last week. As finite creatures, there are inevitable limits both to our reach and our responsibility. Perhaps we think we know we have these limits anyway. Just by living longer, growing older, we've come to realize, I'm sure, that we have dependencies and limits imposed on us by our genes, our upbringing, our culture, our parents, in a way which we never realized when we were younger. But to know ourselves also as creatures of God, not just of our parents and culture, makes that dependency and our limits even more radical. So it should also make the release greater from the angst of thinking we can ever achieve it all. It should free us once for all from the myth of the humanist project of progress, the myth that rationalism and scientific socialism wanted us to believe, that we alone could eventually meet all our ideals by our efforts, individually or collectively. It should release us from all this and should instead form in us a deeper wisdom, a much deeper wisdom, namely a character and a disposition which is much less arrogant, more realistic, simply more relaxed. Another related form of release it should bring is to free us from an over-tragic response to our limits and failed ideals. What I mean by that is a temptation, when we fail to meet all our ideals, to find satisfaction instead in our sense of heroic failure, the temptation to paint ourselves proudly as victims of forces beyond our control, which at least we tried to conquer. I say a temptation because this sort of reaction to compromise or failure just deflects our efforts into portraying ourselves with this heroic sense of self-justification, rather than continuing to pursue the real goal of our original endeavor more realistically in some other way. If you want examples of this from recent political rhetoric, from left and right, perhaps I can suggest a couple. From the left, take, for example, those of you who can remember some of the rhetoric of the miners' strikes back in the 1980s. From the right, perhaps take some recent rhetoric about Europe, say at the time of the election of a new European Commission president. Now, in both cases, protagonists aimed at a sincerely perceived good. In the first case, securing benefits for miners in relation to impending pit closures. In the second, benefits for the British people in relation to impending European hegemony. And in both cases, when each of these goals conflicted with other goals of the time, and their particular goal wasn't secured, that is, the survival of the pits or major concessions from Europe, there was inevitable compromise or indeed failure. But how was that failure then represented by some protagonists? Precisely by heroic tragedy. By representing themselves as going down fighting righteously, in a way which actually just displaced effort from achieving in other ways at least something of what was good about the original goal. Another example, was a previous government's reaction to the long-term failure of the invasion of Iraq. All the same dynamics there. A leader casting himself in the heroic mould, drawing attention to his own integrity, or perceived integrity, but in that very sense of rightness, tending to deflect further constructive efforts to pursue the cause in another way. And the point? Simply that a real grasp of the reality of God, a deep recognition that the ultimate origin and responsibility for all true ideals is actually the mind of God, not ourselves, renders this sort of tragic, self-regarding response just faintly ridiculous. And so it frees us, as nothing else can, from the fantasy that we always have to be seen to succeed. And it should again, instead, form in us the sort of character which is more realistic, humble, and relaxed. And yet, and this perhaps is the most important, and yet, the final practical implication of setting the moral impulse in this religious frame is that it also can and should re-motivate us too. Because even as it helps us see our limits and failures as inevitable and releases us from the burden of thinking we have to achieve everything, it should also help us see them as redeemable. And that is re-energizing. Because if we see these pressing ideals not just as an abstract moral or social demand, but as the will of a personal God relating to us personally, a wholly different reaction to compromise and failure becomes possible. After all, when we fail, an abstract cause or an ideal cannot support us, nor can it forgive. It can only condemn. But a personal God can both support and forgive. He can pick us up, keep us pressing forwards, rather than withdrawing, rather than giving up, or worse, rather than fantasizing heroically. And so herein perhaps lies the real practical genius essence of this sort of religious worldview. In the face of thwarted ideals and a sense of moral failure, it combines a sense of release from it and an extraordinary continued motivation to keep pressing towards the ideals. Does anyone? Can anyone really live like that? Are people in public life ever really so deeply formed in a religious disposition like that? Doing God is rarely admitted. But as last week, I do offer one exemplar, which we can offer because we have access to his diaries and letters. That's Dag Hammarskjöld, the second Secretary General of the United Nations. He never paraded his faith, but it is clear from his diary and his letters just how deeply he was formed in his character, in his deepest dispositions, by a rich inner life of reflection on the religious nature of the ideals he held and was pursuing. It was a spirituality, a theology drawn from a Christian Lutheran upbringing, and later from Christian mystics too, and from Jewish and Eastern spiritualities as well. And what is particularly clear is how he experienced this personal divine will, not as a series of abstract edicts and principles which could all be perfectly kept, but precisely as the experience of a personal will who could and would continually inspire him through a long narrative of trying, failing, trying again. What Hammarskjöld thought he was doing was not just trying to carry out abstract ideal principles. It wasn't an examination in ethical mathematics, making principles add up which just don't in this world. He was experiencing this moral impulse precisely as a person, a personal will, supporting him, forming his character over time, forgiving and restoring him when necessary. It's also clear that in this experience, Hammarskjöld never saw himself as anything other than just one partner with God in projects which he knew he alone would never solve, so would always have to trust God would pick up the pieces through others where he fell short. And that is what motivated him. That's the full measure of what summoned him to enter the minefield of Gaza, Suez, Congo crisis, Cold War tensions. And what sustained him and helped him carry on purposively, even when he was thwarted and when he was exhausted and personally vilified for his efforts. It wasn't just abstract principles of justice, democracy, and freedom. It was this sense of summons and support within a personal relationship with the divine. And it kept him motivated without him becoming either cynical or fantasizing or retreating to self-aggrandizement. I'm really not wanting to canonize Hammarskjöld. I'm sure he was human like the rest of us. But so much of that is really there. This sense of a realistic, humble, yet utterly motivated partnership with God and others. And it's beautifully captured in quite a lot of the fragments from those diaries. I just quote one briefly. "In spite of all the impossibilities I have experienced, all that matters," he wrote, "is a slow building up of what we're all striving for together, and my capacity to vanish as an end and remain purely as a means." What a long way that is from heroic posturing. So tonight, all I've wanted to do is this. First, just to establish that this assumption that there really are real pressing ideals is a defensible one. They don't reduce to other things. The moral impulse cannot be deconstructed into something less real and less pressing. It does have unique authority and character. And then secondly, as such, to suggest this impulse only really makes full sense within a religious metaphysic, and to acknowledge that explicitly. And then finally, to say more about this matching metaphysic of the soul, which can and should be formed in us, this character, this disposition, which will be both realistic and yet always able still to press forward, even when the eye sees further than the hand can reach.